I went to review the present political situation. I'm afraid my partisanship will show up here. And I apologize ahead of time to anybody who's going to be offended by some of the things I'll say. I believe that we're approaching an economic crash, not because I'm a good enough economist, but because a majority of economists believe that in 85 or in 86 there will be an appreciable crash, primarily as a result of deficits of $200 billion per year. The only reason, as I understand it from reading economists, that it hasn't happened before is because we are, with our already high interest rates, draining capital funds out of Europe and out of the Arabian countries. And that's why our government can keep on borrowing, and that's why industry can keep on borrowing because of this money coming from abroad. But that's very precarious, because if they get a little bit nervous about what's going to happen in the United States, they may snatch their money back and sort of pull the rug out from under the whole economy. Another disturbing thing about the present political situation as a result of politics is the rich are getting richer, as you know. That's, the figures show that very clearly, and the poor are getting poorer. The mood in America, obviously, is very self-centered at the present time. Moods keep swinging like tides coming in and they're going out, but this is this country is in a mood where there's a lot of self-centeredness at all age periods. We have a president who says nuclear war can be won. I think this is myself a very dangerous attitude. I've never heard another responsible person saying that outside of the Pentagon. Our president is also on record as saying that America will not gain by disarmament, that America has everything to gain by rapid escalation of the arms race. He says because we're technologically and in other respects richer than the Soviet Union, they won't be able to keep up with us, and that after a while, if we make all necessary sacrifices, that we'll get so far ahead of the Soviet Union that they'll throw up their hands in surrender. I don't think there's any evidence of that from history. The United States has always invented the new weapons, and the Soviet Union has always felt obliged to keep up. Meanwhile, we're bankrupting the country in trying to get ahead. He also scares me, when he says the Soviet Union is the evil empire, and that this is where all the harm in the world is coming from. I'm scared that he's itching to get further involved in Nicaragua. We're already at war in Nicaragua. As you know, we've mined the harbors. We're building airfields and other installations in Honduras. And the president and his cabinet talk all the time about we're going to push them to the wall in one way or another, even if we have to invade them. Another thing that I think is very dangerous politically in this country is that we take a paranoid attitude toward the Soviet Union and then every other communist country. I don't approve of the things that the Soviet Union has done, but I think that to blame all our problems on the Soviet Union is a self-delusion. And people who become self-deluded get into trouble because they don't see the realities clearly. And what our country particularly focuses on in recent years is the invasion of Afghanistan, apparently having no realization that we've been invading countries in Latin America for years. Guatemala, we overthrew a popularly elected government under Eisenhower. Under Johnson, we invaded the Dominican Republic. We helped to overthrow and murder the president of Chile, who was elected in a popular election. always on the basis we will not tolerate a country being governed in a way that we don't like, that we interpret as a threat. That's exactly what the Soviet Union has done to those countries that encircle it, including Afghanistan. I think that it's wrong for the Soviet Union, I think it's wrong for the United States, but it's perilous when we say, look at how bad they are in Afghanistan without realizing what we're doing right now in Nicaragua. I think that a nuclear annihilation can come either from brinkmanship, one country challenging the other, it can also come from accidents. There are constant accidents happening. You know, one of the ones that we laughed at was armed forces, Air Force misinterpreted a flock of Canadian geese as the Russians coming and sent out the message, get the planes up in the air and headed for the Soviet Union. The mistake was discovered in time. And 3 years ago, this fall, there was a soldier in that huge cave in the Rocky Mountains where they collect all this data. A soldier was fooling around with a War Games tape. And by mistake, he put it into the for real slot. And the message went out to all the bases, the Russians are coming. This is what the War Games tape said. And the planes went up, but were called back. Anyway, I think all of these things, these causes of strain, causes of terrible strain, can be corrected, some of them taking much longer than others, if we will recognize what the difficulties are and take the necessary steps. I think there should be different values in upbringing our children. I think we should focus as little on competition as we possibly can. The human species is naturally a pecking order species, and you'll never get rid of competitiveness. But instead of whooping it up, we should be toning it down, I believe, to make for less tension in our society. I think there should be no spanking of children. In most parts of the world, they don't find it necessary to spank children. It's an American tradition to whack kids. You will outrage 80% of American parents, citizens, by saying that. They believe that you can't bring up a child to be a decent, responsible being without hitting him from time to time. I say, you're talking to an audience, you know, when the boss at the office or the factory is dissatisfied with somebody's work, he doesn't come flying in with a stick and hit the person over the throat. He says, would you come to the office to talk to you? He explains what kind of improvement he wants. This works with children. I've known hundreds of children who've never been hit and who've never been stood up in the corner, who are still very cooperative and polite children. We got to get that word out to American people. Don't hit them. This is what leads to brutality. This is what leads to bullying. This is what leads to America being on the edge of taking over countries that don't want us to take over because we think that we're bigger and stronger. I think we should forbid our children to watch television and have violence. And we should refrain from buying them guns. I think we should bring them up with constant emphasis, not grim emphasis, but a pleasant emphasis on cooperation, love. Service. I think we should tell them, you're not in this world just for self-fulfillment, though self-fulfillment is fine. There are terrible problems in your locality, in the nation, and in the world. And you're in the world to try to help solve those problems. That's bringing up children with different values. And those are some samples. The other thing that we've got to do in America, I think, to change the country is to become much more politically active. Half the American people don't bother to vote. And this is shocking. This is turning over the country to special interests. We need political activity to get daycare centers. In our country, you don't get anything by sitting there wringing your hands. You've got to go out and make a stink. that's how you get things, by working through the PTA and being careful who gets elected to the school board, and demonstrating at times. Minority of our schools are excellent, and they encourage such qualities as problem solving and initiative and responsibility and creativity. But a majority of our schools are hardly better than penal institutions that children hate and that teachers scorn for education. And then there's finally disarmament. I think the only way to get rid of the nuclear danger is to get rid of all the nuclear arms. How do you do it? It's a political matter. You have to vote. You have to do things like write letters. A lot of people think that it's namby-pamby to write letters. That doesn't do any good. In recent years, I've gotten to know lots of senators and congressmen. They all say the same thing, that letters, especially if there's any volume of them, make a real impression. We ought to be scaring those people who are always voting for higher escalation of the arms race and thereby bankrupting the country. If you ask people, why don't you write to the president, to your representatives in Congress, they give excuses like, not just how to express the letter. You have to explain to them that the president doesn't call in the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense to show them a bunch of letters and say, look at some of the letters I've been getting here. Look at the margins. Look at the spelling. The chances are that the president doesn't see your letter, but somebody is obligated to read them, find out which pile it goes into, pro or con. And then that person is obligated to tell the president every week how the letters are, how the mail is going. You can lobby. It's not hard to lobby. You feel a little awkward the first time you do it. You don't even have to go to Washington. Your representative and your senators have offices in your own state. And you just get a group. It's better not to go. I mean, it's wasteful to go alone. You go with a dozen other people. You make an appointment ahead of time and you tell them that we are the Palo Alto parents for nuclear disarmament or something. In other words, you always identify yourself by an organization, so the person you talk to wonders whether you're representing 100 or 500 or 1,000 of people. And this is good for him to have that doubt, whereas if you go alone, then he says, well, I can ignore one person. You can organize or join organizations that are already working for nursery schools, daycare centers, and better public schools, and certainly for disarmament. You can contribute money. You can go to demonstrations. That then is even civil disobedience demonstrations. It's not for everybody. It's very nerve-wracking to a middle-class type like myself. I remember the first time I picketed before the Board of Education in Cleveland. I felt like an ass going round and round in an oval, carrying a sign that the passersby didn't seem to recognize the message. When you demonstrate civil disobediently, it's nice to have clergymen, at least a few clergymen sprinkled among the group. It gives you the feeling that you can't be all wrong, and it also makes the police very nervous. They're not used to arresting clergymen. I'll tell you about a time, and then we'll get to discussion, about a time when I was invited to go with 150 clergymen on a civil disobedience demonstration in Washington in the Capitol Rotunda. It gives you an idea. You certainly don't get violent in the kind of civil disobedience that I've been involved in a dozen times. In fact, you hardly have to do anything. In this particular case, all you have to do is disobey the regulation of the Capitol Police that you must clear the rotunda by 4:30 in the afternoon. And the 150 clergymen and I are sitting on the floor singing hymns. The cop comes in and says, gentlemen, time to get out. And everybody pretends not to pay any attention. And then he goes and calls the chief of Apple Police, who comes in with a copy of the regulations, law so-and-so, code so-and-so. But his hand is trembling now because it's all clergymen. And this sets up all kinds of conflicts of duty in his mind. Does he do his duty? But he's been taught to respect their clergymen, so that's what makes him tremble, so that the law, the piece of paper with the law on that trembles and crackles. The only really bad time is when he sends for 25 policemen, and when you're sitting there pretending you're not paying any attention, and the policemen advance on you, you feel, what would my mother say? What would my father say? All through my childhood, I was a goody-goody. I was scared to death of the police. My mother always gave me the idea, you've got to obey what the policeman says. Well, he takes you by the elbow. From then on, it's all downhill. It's all relaxing. They mug you. They fingerprint you. Then they lead you, if you're demonstrating at the Capitol in Washington, they lead you down that enormous flight of stairs that goes down to where they cabs and other cars come in, and your supporters who can't afford to be jailed because they have children to cook for that night, they're standing on the side, they clap when you come down, and quite proud of yourself. Sometimes in Washington you get put into a paddy wagon that has no windows and just slippery seats on the two sides, and when they always allow the most sadistic policemen to drive these. They drive full speed right up to the red light, and then jam on the brake, and everybody crashes up because there's nothing to hang on to. And then when the light goes green, he guns it, and everybody just slams away the night. But at this particular time, they were using the open buses, the buses with open windows, but bars in them. And clergymen were so excited to be bad boys at last that they were wildly excited as they drove down the street. They would stick their arms out through the barred windows, making the V sign that passes by. And it was comical to watch the faces of the pedestrians who've never seen three busloads of clergymen being drunk off to jail, giving a V sign out the window. They'd watch us this way, and then a faint smile. They still couldn't quite understand it, but they thought it was amusing, and they'd give the V sign back. When we got to jail, one of the clergymen smuggled in a Bible. You're not meant to bring anything with you. Take away your eyeglasses and everything else that you could possibly commit suicide with. And this Bible was passed up and down the cell block, and each clergyman would read a favorite passage, and then we'd sing again. The hymns were marvelous. The acoustics in the jail are ideal, better even than a bathroom. It's all concrete floors, walls, and ceiling, and the hymns reverberate. And clergymen have had a lot of practice leading hymn singing, you know, because they have to do it. They have to learn the hymns, and they have to learn to be good singers. Well, most demonstrators, and I'm finishing up now, most demonstrators will quiet down about midnight, the latest at 1 o'clock in the morning, when the clergyman is so excited that at 3 o'clock in the morning, they were all wide awake still, ready to sing another hymn. Well, the point, I don't want to focus on any one of these activities. All I'm saying is if we're going to get a better society, we've got to apply political pressure. And this is the obligation, I think, as well as the satisfaction of all citizens. What you ought to do is decide what's comfortable for you. And if it's comfortable to write letters, then write letters. But don't just write one letter. You don't have to wait for 4 years to write another letter to the president, or 2 years to write to another congressman. You can write every 2 weeks. My own feeling is that I write whenever I get scared again or every time I get angry again. And often that's once a month or sometimes every 2 weeks. Do it. Keep on doing it. It's like being given a chance to vote again. Okay? I'd like to get into some discussion. Anybody who wants to argue? Yes, way back.
Yeah, I was wondering if you
had an
idea that
you've
had political suggestions.
For doing what?
Do you have any good
initiatives for reducing competition?
Yeah.
Well, I think that most American parents are inducing competitiveness in their children, and I think what we have to do is persuade them not to induce it, but to play it down by substituting love, cooperation, service. At what? At schools. Well, what I say is, how about having your major sports being touch football, pickup team Saturday afternoon? That would be my idea of a pleasant sport. What about frisbees? I think that frisbee throwing is an ideal kind of a sport. Anyway, to try to get away from the terrific pressure to win, and you not only, if you have a winning team, then you've got a chance of going to one of the bowls on around Christmas or New Year's time. I would like to get rid of all of that and say sports are for enjoyment, for help, and for learning skills. If you changed it all to frisbees now, I imagine there'd be a California championship, and then there'd be a national championship. The itch to turn everything into a competition is deep-seated, but I think it needs to be tackled. I live in Arkansas now on a lake, a beautiful lake, 70 miles long, and it's got good fishing. Back in the early 19th century, you see pictures of the fisherman, English prince of a fisherman. He has a black top hat. He has a cutaway jacket of green, and he has maybe some yellow tight-fitting pants, and he's standing in a beautiful meadow casting into the stream for trout. In Arkansas, on Beaver Lake, the fishermen drive sparkling boats around 16 to 25 feet long with 100 horsepower outboard engines, and they go so fast that the fisherman has to turn his fishing cap around with the visor behind so that the cap doesn't blow off in the wind, and the rooster tail goes up 6 feet up in the boat. And I asked one of these fishermen one time, why do you have to go so fast? He says, oh, don't you know? Once a year there's a fishing competition here, and if you don't have a fast boat, it would be hopeless to try to win because you might have to rush from one good fishing spot to another good fishing spot. You can turn in America, you can turn anything into a contest. Now, when you say, am I realistic? I'm realistic in thinking that it's important to cut it down. Whether any Americans will ever listen, I don't know. They certainly aren't listening now. But if any change is going to come, somebody's got to stop it and begin thinking of it. Yes? Right. Well, I think the fundamental mechanism is that you tend to do with your children what was done to you. Now, that doesn't mean that you become an exact replica of your parent. And there are many Americans who don't like the way their parents did this or the way their parents did that and make a firm resolve. But unless you make a firm resolve, the tendency is to slip back into doing what was done to you. We shouldn't think of that as all pathological, because this is how the good things are passed down too. You know, children between the ages of 3 and 5 particularly are playing what they call house, which is really family, all day long. They say, I'll be the father, you be the mother, we'll make this child be the baby. And then what they do is practice the words of their parents and the actions of their parents. And parents find it very disconcerting when they hear the nagging that these 2-3-year-old parents are giving to their baby. They say, can I be that monotonously disagreeable with my child? But I mean, I didn't mean to slip over into the unattractive behavior. All the good things that we do are repetitions of what our parents did to us. Freud called it repetition compulsion. However, there are other factors that come in. The people who abused their children not only were abused in their own childhood, but they're people who have excessively high expectations of their children, so they get angry at their children with slight provocation. They're people who in general have less of a social life than the average American has. They feel isolated and probably are isolated. Enough work has been done to show that if you work with the parents, you can help them to solve some of their problems, to see their children in a more realistic and not have such high expectations, to find ways of going out and making friends, or if their problem is budgeting, financial, getting help to find out why aren't they able to get jobs and feel more competent. In other words, things can be done. Another student help, maintaining buildings, doing forestry work in the glen and things like that, and they found every few years that the interest in participating in these things would go down and down and down, and then for some reason, known or unknown, it would begin to improve again. It would seem to me, just as a guess, that the most significant thing there was whether young kids in their homes are brought up with a sense of responsibility. I think there are some families where the parents say, if you're discussing shouldn't children have duties, obligations for the family, I've heard a lot of parents say, oh, they're only young ones, let them have a good time. I don't think that's fair to children to bring them up with the feeling that everything will be provided for them. The great thing about children is that they want more than anything else to grow up and be more like their parents and be more responsible. And they start before the age of 2. The mother dusts, the child wants to get hold of some piece of cloth and do some dusting, sees the parent brushing teeth, so the child wants to brush teeth. And by 2.5 or 3, they want to help set the table, and then dry dishes if the family doesn't have a dishwasher. Children have this impulse to become more responsible, and I think what we have to do is be a little smarter and more tactful in encouraging this. I think some parents say, they make more of a mess than be a help. No, says the parents, drop it. Well, you can't say that for a couple of years and then expect the child to be eager to help with these same tasks again a little later. You have to say, oh, you set the table beautifully. And then you say a couple of months later, you've done so well setting the silver that now do you think you could set the dishes? Then you have to know what to do when the children stop for a few days, wanting to be helpful in those respect. And the whole tendency of parents then is to get cross with them and say, listen, you know you're meant to be setting the table or drying the dishes. You have to learn to speak to them just as you would to an adult. Honey, I'm short of time tonight. Do you think you could help me by setting the table the way you've done it before? That is to say, we got this long, long tradition of being disagreeable to children, to minimizing children, to scolding them, unnecessarily, and we take away all their joy in being responsible for people. So I'd say that's the main thing. You've got to take these people who won't help you here at Stanford University, get them back into early childhood, and be a foster parent, and teach them to be helpful back then. But I think it also depends on the attitude of the administration, whether they show appreciation, the attitude of the faculty, and so on. I think that a whole, I'm sour on the whole educational system, that we tend to emphasize the wrong things, like grades, instead of giving students opportunities to have real jobs. So whether it's in elementary school, high school, or whether it's in the university, I think that everybody should have jobs outside and then come in and discuss in the class what they learned from having the job. I don't think the children necessarily learn from having jobs unless they get a chance to discuss it with the wise and appealing teachers, being kind to them. A lot of people in America don't think that there's any power in this, that this does anything. But I've seen, I said dozens, maybe hundreds of families where the children were very cooperative, were never hit, never stood in a corner. And it's done just as relations between adults. If somebody's visiting you, a good friend, and they're not helping, you don't say, "Come on now, put down that magazine and help me. Can't you see that I'm visiting?" You say to your friend, "Helen, could you help me with peeling the potatoes here," or whatever it is. And people like, in general, to do things for other people that they love and who treat them with respect. I know that this doesn't sound plausible to you if you're one of the 80% of Americans who believe that you can't bring up a child right without hitting them from time to time. But I, yes. I think it emphatically should be changed, that the disadvantages that women have, and they have terrible disadvantages in adulthood, come from a gradual accumulation of discriminations from early childhood. And I think that children, for instance, should be allowed to play and ask for gifts that they want, not that are sex stereotype. I didn't realize this at all when my first child was 3 years of age. He asked for a doll, and my wife said, "Mike's asked for a doll. Is it all right for me to get him one?" In the first place, she shouldn't have asked in such a supplicating way, right? She should have gone at it more as if she was going to decide it as much as I. And I said, "What are you trying to do? Turn him into a girl?" Of course, that's not what he was trying to do in asking for a doll. He wanted to play the parent, and we should encourage that. There would be more fathers who were more helpful with their children if all boys were encouraged to have a doll when they asked for it around the age of 3 or 4. I think they should dress as they want to. I think that as far as chores are concerned, they ought to be assigned on a non-sex basis, that it shouldn't be that girls do the housework or help with the housework and boys help mowing up the lawn, sweeping the garage, or washing the car. But I think also that the boys do tend to watch their fathers in trying to be like their fathers, and girls watch their mothers. So mothers have got to rake the leaves and help to wash the car, and fathers have got to make the beds and do vacuuming, right? Those are some examples. This is a real problem, as you know. A few years ago, I was asked to speak in Toronto, Montreal, I guess it was, and the meeting was had been called by Planned Parenthood, and they asked me to pay particular attention to the problem of teenage pregnancy. So I called my friend Oki Maxson, who was born and raised a Swede, but has worked in this country, got a lot of his training in this country, and is a child psychiatrist at the present time in New York. And I knew that in Sweden, the Swedes, with their very realistic and practical sense, had said, well, if the lack of sex education is the problem, let's give them all the sex education, whether the parents want it or not, in school. And let's have contraceptives in the basement of the school. And that, they've been doing that for years in Sweden. You can go down and put in a quarter and get a contraceptive. Well, I said, okay, how has that worked? And he says, just as many teenage pregnancies and just as much venereal disease as ever. There's something that's not at all logical in a majority of teenagers. You know, that of the teenagers who are sexually active, whether it's at 14, 15, 16, 17, something like only 15 or 20% of them use any contraceptive. And you ask them, listen, did you ever hear of pregnancy and the disadvantage of pregnancy at this age when it will interfere with your education and so on? And they give all kinds of irrational answers. Well, I was sexually active last month and I didn't get pregnant, so I'm not going to get pregnant this month. Others say, my parents don't understand me, I'm miserable, and I could have a baby. I would love the baby and the baby would love me and I'd be happy. I mean, the answers given make no sense at all. It's very hard for a person who's at a logical age period, has been brought up logical, hard to understand that. I've talked to obstetricians and they say, you just have to be persistent. You have to send the child, send the girl and the boy to an obstetrician, gynecologist, as soon as there's the slightest suspicion that the child might be having intercourse. And then you have to see to it that they get the whatever precaution they're going to use. And I think boys as well as girls should be told they should use the precautions. And then the obstetrician says you have to keep nagging them. You have to keep asking, are you using your the pill, or are you using the condom like the doctor said you should? In other words, they always want to slip away from it. Have you heard of anything better? They got peer education. Well, what's happening that there's only 85% haven't gotten the peer education? You mean stimulated by adults, teachers? Has it? What about nuclear war? Well, to give a quick answer, my feeling is that a good thing for a teacher or a parent to say is there is a chance of nuclear war, but it doesn't have to happen if enough of us persuade the government to get rid of the arms, which I happen to believe is true. So it's for me, it would be an honest answer. And then I would say, as a parent, I belong to SANE, or I belong to Mobilization for Survival, or some other disarmament group. I contribute money. I write to my senators. I write to the president. I go to demonstrations. I'm pretty sure that this works to a degree. I heard just a couple of weeks ago about a child, let's say A, and a child B, they're about 6 years of age, child B says, are you worrying about nuclear bombs? And the child A says, my parents are taking care of that. In other words, it is comforting to children to hear that their parents are doing something and that there doesn't have to be nuclear annihilation. I think it's also good for a parent to say, why don't you write to say to the child or a teacher, why don't you write to the president? I would say is that if the subject comes up and is discussed in class, say to the whole class, why don't you all write letters to the president telling him you hope that he will reduce and gradually get rid of the nuclear arms? Yes. He says, children are realistic, and he's talking about his children who, as teenagers, rather cynical about having been encouraged to think that by writing letters going to Washington, they were going to change the course of events. And now as teenagers, they see this hasn't happened. Well, it all depends on how many people will do it. And I think you can also say to kids, nothing happens that fast. Takes years to change things. Might as well get, not only might as well, better get started, because it's going to take a long time to get real disarmament. Battle their way into a stadium to watch a football game, fill it up to 90,000 people, and be glad to pay $10, $20 a ticket to do that. Several years ago, the Reagan administration had a proposal for taxing dividends at source. People are meant to pay income tax on their dividends, but most people forget about the dividends, and it's very difficult for the government to check up on. So this wasn't a proposal for a new tax, it was a proposal to collect the tax in a different way, through the corporation or through the bank or somewhere else. And they said that Congress had never gotten such a blizzard of mail. Here are people happy, excited to write about saving $25 a year, but about saving their lives. They have somehow a feeling it's too overwhelming. I'm too powerless to have any influence there. Yes. The greatest, his question is, said that girls are less good at math than boys. That's what you said. What's the basis for this, and what could be done about it? Well, you know, that whole matter of boy-girl inborn differences is highly controversial, and I got myself skinned alive years ago by making rash statements about the inborn nature of boys and girls. I was denounced by Gloria Steinem. I thought and thought and finally admitted that I was a sexist and revised Baby and Child Care in 1976 to get all the sexism out of it. And a year or so ago, Ms. Magazine chose some heroes, some male heroes of the women's movement, and I was one of those chosen. So I reformed myself, and I'm scared of answering the question about the inborn difference about that. I think what I can say safely, that there's been tremendous prejudice against girls about a whole line of occupations, mathematics, physics, engineering, and general competence as executives, too emotional. Well, obviously, a lot of those created additional prejudice. I mean, by the time it's accepted that girls aren't as good as this or that or the other, then it's harder for girls to prove themselves in school in these areas. So the most important thing, I think, in this whole matter is the prejudice. And the first thing is to get rid of the prejudice and then see how girls do in math and in physics, not just a few girls, but statistical studies. You're setting a program, I mean, setting up an experiment that's almost totally unrealistic, because after all, even if you've never used the word boy or girl, boys get the idea in a dozen different ways that they're like their father, and the girls get the idea that they're like their mother. And so if you don't even call them boys and girls, boys are going to be watching their father more carefully. And that's why when they're playing house, the boy says, "I'll be the father." And then he says to the girl, "You be the mother." And then he says, "Well, dear, I've got to go down to the office. Is the one thing you want me to get down?" In other words, he is playing the father's part because he thinks that that's a more exciting one, because he sees he's in that mold. And I think that that is inborn in people, for children, and to keep an eye on parents generally, but particularly by the age of three, particularly on the parent of the same sex, and to try to emulate them. I saw one tantalizing study came out of Israel, and I can't remember which book it was. I don't think it was the Chicago one. That was my thing. It said here, you know, in Israel, children of both sexes are taken care of by child care people who are, I guess, overwhelmingly, if not exclusively, female. And so the identification would be mainly with the female sex for boys as well as for girls. And I don't remember all the details, but one thing that fascinated me was that the general statement, boys show their identification with their female caregivers in many respects, but in one respect they're very different from girls. That it's boys who are playing their airplanes or their automobiles, you know, like this, flying through the air. In other words, the identification with machines seemed to be mostly with boys and not nearly as much with girls. I don't know whether you can... I don't want to give that as a final conclusion about anything, but I thought it was very interesting where the identification...